80 years ago, Pearl Harbor. Tonight we're going to try and look at the real story behind the attack on Pearl Harbor, which continues to have a great impact in the world today. But at this time, as we are facing the most extraordinary lockdown lunacy, masquerade madness, salvation by vaccination, COVID cult, it's worth reminding ourselves that governments have lied to us consistently on a prodigious scale. First question, was the attack on Pearl Harbor really an unprecedented surprise, as the narrative tells us? My history teacher, Mr. Rhys Davies in Rhodesia, who was also a member of Parliament in Rhodesia, he cautioned us, beware the victor's version of history. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. Governments lie. There's never a ministry of truth to unravel the lies told during wartime. And he said, beware the victor's version. Don't regurgitate the textbook. If you knew how textbooks were produced by committees, you wouldn't put any faith in them. And he used to tell us, think outside the box, do your own research. Well, the claim that no one could have anticipated torpedo attacks in the shallow waters of a harbour before the 7th of December 1941 is false. The British had proved that torpedoes could be very effective in the attack on the Italian Navy at Taranto, 11th of November 1940, a full year before. The Royal Navy used swordfish biplanes, which you would have thought were completely redundant, out of date, First World War type vintage aircraft. But they used these biplanes to good effect to deliver the torpedoes. On the night of the 11th to the 12th of November 1940, British naval forces under Admiral Andrew Cunningham, including the aircraft carrier HMS Illustrious, launched Fury swordfish biplane torpedo bombers in the Mediterranean Sea to attack the Regina Marina, or the Royal Navy of Italy, their battle fleet at anchor in the harbour of Taranto. Mussolini was the head, El Duce, of Italy at the time, and pride of the Italian armed forces was their battle fleet, the Regina Marina. Very powerful battleships, we might say, which could have caused the British some grief in the Mediterranean. Here is a contemporary picture from the Italians of their battle fleet at anchor in Taranto. Despite the shallow depth of the water, the aerial torpedoes proved devastatingly effective, crippling the Italian Navy, which lost half of its battleships in one night. Two biplanes carrying torpedoes. Extraordinary. The wisdom at that time was this would not be effective, but they proved devastatingly effective. The first wave came in from west to east. The second wave came in from north to south. And they managed to sink a huge amount of the Italian Navy, with very little losses on the British side. Here's some pictures taken during the actual battle, showing the devastation. You can see the oil slicks coming from these sunken ships, stricken ships in the harbour. They were sitting ducks, even for ferry swordfish biplanes. The Royal Navy raid on Taranto Bay marked the ascendancy of air power over sea power. The fleet air arm now proved to be the Navy's most devastating weapon. So it wasn't Pearl Harbor that marked this, it was Taranto. Here's some pictures at the time, historically, these swordfish biplanes on Illustrious preparing. This was sensational. This was the stuff of novels and films. It was big news. Everyone in the whole world knew about it, especially if you're in aviation or in the Navy. It was the biggest news out there. And the US Navy had discussed this very new threat in June 1941 in a memorandum. Torpedo nets were considered as a precautionary method to be installed in Pearl Harbor as a result of Taranto. But Admiral Kimmel and his staff testified that the decision not to install torpedo nets and booms had been made by the Navy Department in Washington, D.C., not in Hawaii. Hawaii, the local commanders wanted to put up torpedo nets. Washington, D.C. said no. Question: was the Japanese raid on Pearl Harbor really unprecedented? 17 months before Pearl Harbor, the British Royal Navy attacked the French fleet at anchor on the coast of French Algeria. That, by the way, is in Africa, not in Europe. The Battle of Mers El Kabar on the 3rd of July 1940 resulted in the deaths of 1,297 French servicemen, the sinking of a French battleship, the damaging of five other ships. The combined air and sea attack carried out against Britain's official ally without any declaration of war against France, which was Britain's ally on the 3rd of July, was very controversial, and it created a lot of controversy and hostility between France and Britain to this day. Britain argued the times were desperate, invasion seemed imminent, which was actually a lie. There never was any plan of invasion of Britain. Germany never made a landing craft. They never had an aircraft carrier. They never designed a plane that could fly from an aircraft carrier. How on earth would they invade Britain when they didn't even have a landing craft? Not one. But nevertheless, that Operation Sea Lion was a nice propaganda tool to keep the British people in check, and Winston Churchill milked it for all it was worth. But anyway, they were saying invasion seemed imminent, although Germany had zero interest in invading England. The British government simply could not afford risking Germany seizing control of French fleet. The prominent British motive was thus dire necessity and self-preservation. This is, it sounds reasonable, it just isn't true. The French insisted that as the terms of surrender with Germany did not require them handing over their fleet, which was still in French-controlled territory, and the British action was considered treacherous. And this is also interesting, pointed out by Pat Buchanan in The Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost its Empire and the West Lost the World. He says, how could Germany have been planning world domination when it didn't have one single aircraft carrier? Britain had 11, America had 13. Why, how on earth are you going to have world domination without an aircraft carrier? When the German Navy was one-tenth, literally 10% of the Royal Navy size, how could they? And if they really wanted that, they should have seized the French fleet, was a third of the size of the Royal Navy, three times larger than the Kriegsmarine, and therefore the French fleet would have been tremendous, but Germany had even asked for the French fleet in their terms of surrender imposed on France in 1940. So this was considered pretty treacherous. By the way, this isn't totally accurate, because they give Germany one aircraft carrier. Well, they never had an aircraft carrier. They considered the Kraft Spree, but the Kraft Zeppelin, but it never, ever was launched. So that was just the planning stage. Britain had a mountain of aircraft carriers at this stage, and France had two. When it came to battleships, well, of course, Britain beat everyone. When it came to cruisers, Britain had 700% more than Germany did. When it came to destroyers, just outnumbered them in every way. Submarines, Britain had as many submarines as Germany, and France had more than either Britain or Germany. So when it came to naval power, Britain obviously was bigger than the next two combined. And that was always their policy. At the same time, French ships that were in Alexandria, Egypt, who believed they were allies of Britain, suddenly were shocked to be blockaded, boarded, and seized by the Royal Navy. Also on the 3rd of July 1940, French ships in Plymouth and Portsmouth, England, were boarded and captured. Now, this includes the French submarine Surcouf, which is the largest submarine in the world at this time, four other submarines, the battleships Paris and Corbett, destroyers Triumphant and Leopard. Some officers and sailors of the French Navy were killed in the attack on them by the British allies. Now, these attacks were justified by the British strategy of Copenhagen the fleet. Admiral Horatio Nelson's famous Battle of Copenhagen, 2nd of April 1801, was a clear inspiration for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, 1941. Although Denmark was officially neutral during the whole of the Napoleonic Wars, Britain feared that Denmark's navy, which was substantial, could be seized by the French if Denmark fell to the French, which it never did. The Battle of Copenhagen was a result of multiple failures of diplomacy, to put it nicely. The British never even tried to negotiate with the Danes or make any kind of assurances. They just decided to enforce a strict blockade of France and any country that traded with France, even neutral nations like Denmark, Sweden, and Prussia. They were regarded as legitimate targets even for just having economic trade, but despite them being neutral. Admiral Sir Hyde Parker and Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson led the attack on the Danish capital of Copenhagen, famously portrayed in this painting. The British attack, during which Admiral Nelson famously placed his telescope to his blind eye, ignoring the command to withdraw, was, from the British perspective, spectacularly successful. Turning a blind eye to things dates from Battle of Copenhagen, Admiral Horatio Nelson. 1,600 Danish sailors and soldiers were killed or wounded, and most of the Danish navy was sunk, severely damaged or captured. Although ostensibly neutral, Denmark was again attacked by the British Royal Navy 16th of August all the way through to the 5th of September in 1807, 6 years later, when the Royal Navy bombarded Copenhagen, the capital, seized the Danish fleet as a precaution in case Denmark did choose to join the French, which they never did. These are some paintings of the time, of the destruction of Copenhagen by the Royal Navy. 3,000 soldiers and civilians, including 195 children in Copenhagen, died as a result of the bombardment. Now bear in mind, Denmark was neutral. No declaration of war was made on Denmark. And as the majority of the Danish army was at the southern border to protect against a possible attack from France, this second assault on a neutral country was a scandal at the time. Now, knowing that the Imperial Japanese Navy was modeled on the Royal Navy and trained by them, these famous battles and these strategies and these tactics of Copenhagen the fleet of even a neutral country where any potential threat was perceived, including Britain's French allies, and most tellingly at the Battle of Taranto, where aircraft using torpedoes launched from an aircraft carrier crippled a battle fleet, all this should have been taken into consideration by the Americans. And it was. Note how the Japanese Navy looks very much like the European navies. In fact, they modelled their rank structure entirely on the British. The British trained the Imperial Japanese Navy. The British and the Japanese were allies in the First World War, and the Royal Navy was not only the model for the Imperial Japanese Navy, they were the trainers. And looking at this, you could almost think you're looking at a Royal Navy picture. Actually, this is the Imperial Japanese Navy. They were self-consciously, deliberately modelled on the Royal Navy. And hence, after the Second World War, the British could produce a book like this, Old Friends and New Enemies. Because Japan and Britain were very good friends and allies during the First World War. And the warships of the Imperial Japanese Navy even looked like they were made, modelled on the British naval ships. Now, modern American films like Toya, 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 which was fairly and seriously accurate. They really tried to be accurate, but it's what they left out that I'm talking about here. And Pearl Harbor, which is complete and utter fiction. As Bill Batten said, it's a love story masquerading as a war story. But these ignored the historic precedents. They pretended that the attack on Pearl Harbor was both unprecedented and unexpected. The first surprise attack by aircraft on ships. Generations have been deceived into thinking that Pearl Harbor was a treacherous, unexpected, unprecedented attack, a day that will live in infamy, which says more about propaganda than the facts of history. Admiral James Richardson, who had been in charge of the Pacific Fleet before Kimmel, he was fired by President Roosevelt for complaining about the President's order to station the Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor. The Pacific Fleet did not base itself in Pearl Harbor, it was based in San Diego, on America's western flank, on the western coast. It was not logical for them to put the entire Navy in Pearl Harbor, 2,000 miles away from the western coast of the United States, and in a very vulnerable position. Admiral Richardson blamed President Roosevelt for initial defeats in the Pacific as a direct, personal, real consequence of his choices. And here's Admiral Richardson taking oath before the Congressional Pearl Harbor investigation where he testified of this. Richardson believed that stationing the Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor made the ships extremely vulnerable to attack and provide a poor non-strategic advantage. Now just notice, top right, the very narrow mouth to the Pearl Harbor. If you sunk one battleship in that mouth, the entire navy would be bottled up there. That's how vulnerable they were. Could have the entire fleet bottled up with just one strategic sinking in the estuary in the mouth of this harbor. Extremely dangerous. So why was the Pacific Fleet taken away from San Diego and put in Pearl Harbor just before the attack, both as a threat to Japan and as bait? Captain Stafford, the United States Navy man in charge of communications, security section of Naval Communications in Washington, D.C., testified before the Admiral Hart Board that on the 4th of December, 1941, we received definite information from two independent sources that Japan would attack the United States and Britain at 9 p.m. Washington time, 6 December 1941. We received positive information that Japan would declare war against the United States at a time to be specified thereafter. This information was positive and unmistakable and was made available to military intelligence virtually at the moment of its decoding. The reason why we have fax machines is because in the 1920s, the U.S. Navy had to design a means to get Japanese text over to the United States because they cracked the codes, but they need to decipher them. And so fax machines were specifically invented decades before civilians knew about them or had access to them. We got a first fax machine in 1989. But they had them in the 1920s ready in the U.S. Navy. So they could take Japanese text over to America, and people who were fluent in Japanese could decode it. They knew all the secret traffic of the Japanese Navy at about the same time as their commanders got it. Just took the time to decoding, and so they knew exactly what was coming. Still quoting from this intelligence operative, finally at 10:15 a.m. Washington time, 7 December 1941, we received positive information from Signal Intelligence Service, War Department, that the Japanese declaration of war would be presented to the Secretary of State at 1 p.m. Washington time that date. When it was 1 p.m. in Washington, it would be daybreak in Hawaii and approximately midnight in the Philippines, which indicated a surprise air raid in Pearl Harbor in about 3 hours. President Roosevelt had ample time to broadcast a warning. On December 6, 1941, a message to the Japanese delegation in Washington, D.C. was intercepted, broken, distributed by the Signal Intelligence SIS. Now, bear in mind, these are all things that were heard in investigations 1945 to 1946 in Congress and the Senate. General Albert Wedemeyer is quoted by President Herbert Hoover in Freedom Betrayed as stating, "When on the 6th of December, our intercepts told us the Japanese were going to attack somewhere the very next day, whether in the Central Pacific or in the south of the Philippines or the Dutch Indies, the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief of our military forces, could have gone on the radio and broadcast to the whole wide world that he had irrefutable evidence of an immediate Japanese intention to strike. This would have alerted everyone from Singapore to Pearl Harbor. Even though inadequate in some cases to defend effectively, nevertheless, our forces would have been able to take a toll, which would have blunted the Japanese attack. In Hawaii, the capital ships might have been moved out of the congested harbor to sea, where Admiral Kimmel had at least the foresight to keep the far more vital aircraft carriers. Furthermore, our carrier task force in the mid-Pacific might have attacked the Japanese task force while its planes were aloft. There are many possibilities which have given our men a fighting chance." An army inquiry conducted from July to October 1944 condemned negligence by General Marshall, Chief of Staff, and other senior officers for prior knowledge. They had prior knowledge of the attacks from intercepts and for not having alerted the military commander at Pearl Harbor. Now here's contemporary picture of the USS California damaged by the air attack on the 7th of December 1941. Congress was not satisfied with the military investigations and reports, so from November 1945 to May 1946, the Congressional Pearl Harbor investigation was held. A minority report by Senate members of the committee condemned the endeavor to throw as soft a light as possible on Washington. The Roberts Commission report was so hasty, inconclusive, and incomplete. Some witnesses were examined on oath, others were not. Much testimony was not even recorded. Several records went missing. Most inadequate explanations were supplied. Army and Navy information indicated growing, immense imminence of war delivered to the highest authorities, right up to the President, Secretary of the Navy. The fatal error of Washington was to undertake a world campaign, in other words, a world war, and world responsibilities without first making provision for the security of the United States, which was their prime constitutional obligation. Just see here again the extremely narrow mouth to Pearl Harbor. It is a strategic error to place your Navy in a bottleneck like that. Senior Washington authorities did not communicate to Admiral Kimmel or General Short adequate information of diplomatic negotiations or of intercepted diplomatic intelligence, which, if communicated with them, would have informed them of the imminent menace of a Japanese attack in time for them to fully alert and prepare the defenses of Pearl Harbor. The failure to perform the responsibilities indispensably essential to the defense of Pearl Harbor rests upon Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the President, Henry Simpson, Secretary of War, Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, and George E. Marshall, who was the Chief of Staff of the military. All that approaching from President Herbert Hoover's Freedom Betrayed book. This is the famous telegram on the time, air raid on Pearl Harbor, this is not no draw, 7th of December. Would have been nice if they had been warned a few hours beforehand, of course. George Morgenstern, in his book Pearl Harbor, the Story of a Secret War, published in 1947, wrote, with absolute knowledge of war, they refused to communicate that knowledge clearly, unequivocally, and in time to the people in the field on whom the blow would fall. Pearl Harbor provided the American war party with a means of escaping dependence on a hesitant Congress and taking a reluctant people into war. The American people did not want to go to war. Over 85% opposed involvement in war, in Europe's war. The first president of America, George Washington, warned in his final speech, beware of entangling alliances. Do not get involved in Europe's wars, and so on. And here, they got suckered by Woodrow Wilson into World War I. They lost 115,000 American men in the First World War for no reason. And there was such a rebellion in 1920, they ousted the Democrats from everything. The Republicans took the House, the Senate, the White House, and they enacted laws to make it impossible for America to ever get sucked into a foreign war game, ever to be suckered into war. And the Democrats got America involved in all these different wars, First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War. And Democrats are known as a party that dragged its country into war. So the Republicans won everything in 1920, and they made it so strict. What FDR was doing was completely illegal. It was jail time illegal, treason. And they couldn't get the Congress to declare war, but they managed to provoke Japan to attack them. Pearl Harbor was the first action of the acknowledged war in the last battle of the secret war, upon which the administration of FDR had long since embarked. The secret war was waged against nations which the leadership of this country had chosen as enemies months before they became formal enemies by declaration of war. It was waged also by psychological means, by propaganda and deception against the American people. The people were told that acts that were equivalent to war were intended to keep the nation out of war. Constitutional processes existed only to be circumvented, until finally the war-making power of Congress was reduced to the act of ratifying an accomplished fact. Herbert Hoover, who remember was a Nobel Prize-winning president who had done a lot to save lives. He had saved millions of people from starvation during the First World War, during the war against Finland. He was a wonderful humanitarian, and he was the immediate predecessor to FDR. And he wrote a book that was suppressed for more than 60 years. They suppressed it, and it only came out in 2011. And I've got it, Freedom Betrayed, Doorstopper, 900 and something pages, where he documents the secret activities of American government of FDR before, during, and after the Second World War, and he entitles it Freedom Betrayed. In Freedom Betrayed, he says, it can never be forgotten that three times during 1941, Japan made overtures for peace negotiation with America. America never made one proposal, unless a futile proposal to the emperor the day before Pearl Harbor could be called a peace proposal, which it could not, because it was full of ridiculous, impossible demands. A peace could have been made in the Pacific that would have saved China from ravishment, would have protected the American Pacific flank. If Roosevelt was still determined to carry on his undeclared war with Germany until it provoked reprisals, That Pacific protection was the only sane course. I mean, why start a war in two fronts? It could have limited our engagement in any case to the European theatre. As a result of this policy, an undeclared war in Japan, we suffered the greatest military defeat in our history, with immeasurable consequences. Public opinion was overwhelmingly against our being involved in the war up to the day of Pearl Harbor. America came into World War I 33 months after its outbreak. She came into World War II 27 months after it started. The processes and amounts of lag were the same. The appeal to a crusade for freedom, for independence of nations, for lasting peace, the same pictures of atrocities, the fanning of hate, and above all the massive lies and stimulation of fear of invasion, they were all identical. But in World War II, the people believed much less of it. They'd already been suffered once before. They believed much more that they were being deliberately pushed into the war. They dimly recognized they were being ground in mills of power politics and the personal ambitions of men. I'm reading all this direct from Herbert Hoover's book, Freedom Betrayed. The First World War had been concluded on the Allied side in the name of the peoples. This war was the name of Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt. At times, the whole political military scene seemed like the personal property, as it was. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 could be written across a lot of governments in the world. While they promised them liberty, they themselves were slaves of corruption. In the First World War, our sons marched to war with flowers and their rifles, bands and cheering people on every platform. But there were no bands, no flowers, no cheers on the railway platforms to World War II. There was little singing of war ballads by soldiers or civilians, except at the urging of paid conductors of propaganda. The station platforms were stages for grieving and tears. People remembered, I've done this before 20 years ago and for no good reason. The promises, the speeches, the propaganda filled the air as in World War I. But this time the people received it grimly and with little believing. And all these mindless, crude propaganda posters. And do you know that all Americans of Japanese descent, whether they were aliens or not, whether they were citizens or not, whether they were American born or not, was rounded up and put into concentration camps. 140,000 Japanese, I believe, or Americans of Japanese descent, or partial descent, were locked up in concentration camps during the Second World War. Oust of all Japs in California, yeah. And they were all treated as enemy. Freedom Betrayed, although there was not one case of any Japanese sabotage done on the American mainland once during the whole war. Freedom Betrayed indicts Roosevelt for instigating the Pacific War. His economic sanctions against Japan, which is economic warfare, his shunning of Japanese peace overtures sparked the Pearl Harbor attack, and ultimately the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which Herbert Hoover describes as the act of unparalleled brutality in all of American history. President Herbert Hoover in Freedom Betrayed documents Roosevelt's contemptuous refusal of Prime Minister Conyers' proposal for peace in the Pacific of September 1941 was a lost opportunity. Could have preserved peace in the Pacific. The acceptance of these proposals from Japan were prayerfully urged by both the American and British ambassadors in Japan. That this was the same choice. The terms Conyers proposed would have accomplished every American purpose except possibly the return of Manchuria, and even this was thrown open to discussion. Manchuria is this obscure province over here, which ostensibly is the reason why America went to war with Japan, just like ostensibly Britain went to war in the Second World War to protect Poland, but ended up betraying Poland at the hands of the Soviet Union, just like America ended up betraying Manchuria and North Korea into the hands of the Soviets at the end of the Second World War. So they meant to be the reason you go to war, but at the end you put them in a worse situation than they ever were before. The cynic will recall that Roosevelt was willing to provoke a great war on his flank over this remote question of Manchuria, and then gave Manchuria to the communist Soviet Russians at the end of the war. Now, this is a Life magazine article that came out in 1945, which exposes that the U.S. president knew about, wanted, provoked the attack on Pearl Harbor, and that these facts were known to the Republican presidential candidate Thomas Dewey in 1944, but he withheld his fire on it because of the war. But now the war is over, they decided to bring it up. And so isn't it interesting how these things that people all knew about back in the 40s has been suppressed ever since by the Hollywood versions of history and the textbooks, because they act like everyone was 100% behind the war, which isn't true, and that they thought it was treacherous, unprecedented, and unexpected. But the people time knew, the military knew, they were testifying this. Herbert Hoover documents in Freedom Betrayed that American military officials strongly urged FDR to accept the 3-month standstill agreement offered by the Emperor of Japan in November 1941. Japan was alarmed at the threat of the Soviet Union, as well they should have been, and a 90-day delay could have kept war out of the Pacific. Secretary of War Stimson, in his diary, disclosed that Roosevelt and his officials were seeking for a method to stimulate, provoke an overt act of aggression from the Japanese. And this was the picture they used over and over, of 3 civilians killed in a shrapnel-riddled car by a bomb dropped from a Japanese plane 8 miles from Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December. There they had an atrocity picture they could use. There are many documents related to Pearl Harbor which are still classified to this day, 80 years later, have not yet been made public by the United States government. Many of these documents were actually destroyed by the US government during the war. Some of the public records of the United Kingdom containing Churchill's most secret wartime intelligence briefs have been marked closed for 75 years, which ended 5 years ago, and they're still closed, including the sections dealing with events from November 1941 through March 1942. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's on record stating, "Nothing happens by accident in politics. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way." Actually, that's so true in politics. Just think of that when you think of the COVID cult and Fauci. And remember how last year you could get deplatformed, you could get every kind of thing brought on you if you suggested that the coronavirus was man-made or made in a laboratory, or made in a laboratory in China or Wuhan, in the bacteriological warfare laboratory of the People's Republic of China. Or if you suggested that the American taxpayer or Fauci had something to do with funding it. Well, now it's in the public record. Now it's known. It's been exposed. Senator Rand Paul and his inquiries have proved Fauci knew, Fauci funded it, gain of function. Corona 19 virus, man-made in a laboratory, paid for by US taxpayers, produced by the People's Liberation Army Bacteriological Warfare Laboratory in Wuhan, China. And the whole world's been locked down, all this sort of thing, for something that was man-made and planned from the very beginning. In Day of Deceit by Robert Stinnett, a memorandum prepared by Commander McCullum stated that a memorandum issued in the immediate pre-war period declared that only a direct attack on US interests would sway the American public, which was rock solid, 85% against getting involved in the war. And Congress was totally against it too. And so they weren't interested in America being involved in the European war, so Anderson and Secretary Knox offered 8 specific plans to aggrieve the Japanese Empire, aggrieve, aggravate. Here it is. Details of the McCullum Memorandum, which was sealed till 1995. It is not believed that in the present state of practical political opinion in the United States government is capable of declaring war against Japan without much ado. It is barely possible that vigorous action on our part might lead the Japanese to modify their attitudes. Therefore, the following course of action is suggested. Number one, A. Make an arrangement with Britain for the use of British bases in the Pacific, particularly Singapore. B. Make an arrangement with Holland for the use of some base facilities and acquisition of supplies in the Dutch East Indies. C. Give all possible aid to the Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek, who are fighting with Japan. D. Send a division of long-range heavy cruisers to the Orient, Philippines, or Singapore. E. Send 2 divisions of submarines to the Orient. F. Keep the main strength of the U.S. fleet now in the Pacific in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands. That's putting it 2,000 miles closer to Japan, away from the American coast. Keep the main strength of the U.S. fleet now in the Pacific in the vicinity of Hawaii. G. Insist the Dutch refuse to grant the Japanese demands for economic concessions, particularly oil, starving oil and rubber. H. Completely embargo all American trade with Japan in collaboration with a similar embargo imposed by the British Empire. And so getting Britain, Holland, and America to put economic sanctions on Japan, starving them of the raw materials they needed while they were involved in a war with, amongst others, the communists in China. If by these means Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better. This is the famous McCollum memo that was sealed and only classified in 1994. Jonathan Daniels, Roosevelt's administrative assistant at the time of Pearl Harbor, presented an eyewitness viewpoint. The blow was heavier than he had hoped it would necessarily be, but the risks paid off. Even the loss was worth the price. The loss was worth the price. The loss of the battleships, thousands of lives, worth the price. This is the Honolulu Advertiser, Honolulu newspaper, nation ready for battle. Japanese may strike over weekend. What's the date? November 1941. November 1941, newspaper headlines, Japan may strike over the weekend, and yet we're meant to believe from Pearl Harbor films and Toya, nobody expects. They're all lying on a beach and dreaming of endless holidays, and these nasty Japanese attack them without any provocation, any warning. Nobody expected. Complete surprise. Poor old Roosevelt forced to the floor in shock. Couldn't go on the film. And this happens. It's all theatre. No reasonably informed person can now believe that Japan made a villainous, unexpected attack in the United States. An attack was not only fully expected, but was actually desired. It is beyond doubt that President Roosevelt wanted to get his country into the war, but for political reasons was most anxious to ensure that the first act of hostility came to the other side. It's like someone who comes up to you and pushes you and swears at you and does everything he can and, you know, throws your books into the urinal and bullies you and trips you and so on. Just wait. In a moment, he hit me. I mean, it's that sort of thing. Provoke, and then finally you can say, I'm the victim. For which reason, Roosevelt caused increasing pressure to be put on the Japanese to the point of which no self-respecting nation could endure without resort to arms. Japan was meant by the American president to attack the United States. This is the conclusion of President Herbert Hoover. As Mr. Oliver Layton, the British Minister of Production, said in his book, Main Fleet to Singapore, Japan was provoked into attacking America's Pearl Harbor. It's a travesty of history to say that America was forced into war. Of course, a lot of Americans believed they were forced into war. That's what the propaganda said. But the British were sick of it, and hence in this book by British historian Captain Russell Grenfell, Main Fleet to Singapore, said, you were not forced into the war. You wanted to get in the war. You did everything to bring about the war. You provoked the war. In fact, now the evidence is that, which is presented in Herbert Hoover's Freedom for Trade, FDR's government put up Poland to not give concessions to Germany, put up Britain to give the war guarantee to Poland, put up France with the war guarantee to Poland, that the American government was causing the war on all sides, offering, bribing, cajoling, threatening, and that this was in fact cooked up mostly in FDR's White House office, and that America was not dragged into war, but they in fact pushed the others into the war, which is extremely interesting perspective. William Henry Chamberlain, in America's Second Crusade, published in 1950, wrote, it is scarcely possible, in the light of this and many other known facts, to avoid the conclusion that the Roosevelt administration sought the war that began at Pearl Harbor. The steps which made armed conflict inevitable would take months before the conflict broke out. Then Secretary of State Hull issued his foolish ultimatum and we were defeated at Pearl Harbor. By the way, if you've seen the film Toya, which is actually amazingly accurate insofar as what it focuses on, it's what it leaves out. But in it, the Americans have broken a code. They know exactly what the Japanese ambassador is going to present the Secretary of State. And while they don't make a big thing of it, but you do see in the film the fact that Hull made them keep the Japanese ambassador and his assistant waiting in his waiting room until he got confirmation that the attack on Pearl Harbor had happened. Then he let them in. So it's not that the Japanese didn't deliver the declaration of war on time. It's that they were kept waiting deliberately by the Americans who knew the contents of the declaration. Anyway, it's interesting that that was even brought in there, but that is a fact. They knew about the declaration about the same time as the Japanese ambassador in Washington knew, and they deliberately delayed them delivering it so they could say, we were given declaration of war after the attack began, even though the Japanese emperor insisted that the declaration of war be delivered 1 hour before the attack. And so the facts start to undermine the narrative. By Rutherford insisting that Chinese Premier Chiang Kai-shek ensued Mao Zedong's communist and a coalition government, and at Rutherford's secret agreement at Yalta, betrayed Mongolia and Manchuria to the Soviets under Stalin, future generations were betrayed. So claiming we're going to war with Japan because we're concerned for Manchuria is blatantly false. All of China was sacrificed to the communists in the years of President Truman at the insistence of his left-wing advisors and General George C. Marshall, which honestly, when you get to know the facts, was really a war criminal. The Second World War ended with 450 million Asiatic people betrayed under communist dictatorship in either Red China or North Korea. Herbert Hoover and Freedom Betrayed declared, "I warned the American people time and again against becoming involved. I stated repeatedly its only end would be to promote communism over the earth, that we would impoverish the United States and the whole world. The situation of the world today is my vindication." He wrote this in the 1960s. And he died before his book could get published, and then the government in America suppressed the book for the next 60 years. But that, honestly, is the fact. Rutherford ignored the whole communist infiltration to his administration. Much of it was to be exposed before his death. But of more importance, he ignored the whole international purpose of communism and its morals of international relations. What's he talking about? The communists were talking right from the beginning, "We will bury you. We will spit in your faces and you will call it due. You capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang you. Treaties are like pie crusts made to be broken. To tell the truth is a petty bourgeois habit. To lie and to lie convincingly is a sign of superior intelligence." I mean, these are the stated communist objectives. This is out of the mouth of Lenin himself, where you can take from Stalin. The death of one person is a tragedy, but the death of millions is only a statistic. It's not your votes that counts. It's who counts the votes. Okay. These are the morals of the people dealing with the cops. And yet, FDR had the first General Secretary of the United Nations, Alger Hiss, communist agent. The head of the World Bank and the IMF, communist. Harry Dexter White, you can name it from every... Who did he get to set up the CIA and OSS? Donovan, communist, and so on. And who did they help? The communists. The Bronze Tito in power over the anti-communist resistance forces in Yugoslavia, and you can carry on and on. Its purposes and methods have been blatantly stated to the world ever since 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution. Its statements and books were widely distributed in the United States. Rutherford was not a communist, though his wife was. His leanings towards Stalin and blindness to communist activities arose partly from his own leftist leaning and partly from the usefulness of the communists in support of his administration politically throughout its 13 years in office. The reason why America has got a two-term limit for its presence is FDR. He is a four-term president. He is such a catastrophe and disaster that they brought in laws to prevent any president having more than two terms. Because, and in fact, I was at a Summit Ministries event, a wonderful biblical worldview program with Dr. David Noble up in Colorado Springs, and the people there, this was the early years of Obama's administration, and one of the students said, "Obama's the worst president in American history." I said, "He may turn out to be, but consider this. In 4 years of Jimmy Carter, 13 countries were betrayed in the hands of communism, one in the hands of Islamic crazies in Iran, by direct policy of the U.S. State Department, Jimmy Carter." And as I said this, David Noble, founder of Summit Ministries, also understand how to put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Peter, you're wrong." He said, "In terms of actual damage done, no president of America has been worse than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He betrayed a third of the world's population in the hands of communism." I thought, he's got a strong point. FDR must get the prize for the absolute worst president of American history. I'm afraid that even includes Biden. Embarrassing though he is. Proverbs 17, verse 15, "He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both them alike are an abomination to the Lord." His leanings towards Stalin and the communists began with the recognition of the Soviet Union immediately upon taking office in 1933. One of the first acts of Roosevelt was to recognize the Soviet Union, open up trade with them. During the 15 years prior to this recognition. Democratic and republic administrations alike have barred any relations with the Soviet Union, which had returned huge numbers of mankind to slavery and was constantly conspiring against the welfare of other people. By recognizing the Soviet Union, Roosevelt gave the Soviet Union certain respectability in the family of nations. And also of importance, by that act he opened the door to communist penetration and conspiracies in the United States. And this is also an interesting book, Operation Snow, how a Soviet mole in FDR's White House triggered Pearl Harbor. That's another story. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. In Herbert Hoover's Freedom Betrayed, General Douglas MacArthur's views are reported that the whole Japanese war was a madman's desire to get us into war. MacArthur was convinced that financial sanctions in July 1941 were not only provocative, but Japan was bound to fight, even if it meant suicide. Remember, MacArthur understood the Asiatic mind. He understood the way they thought. The Japanese culture is an honor-shame culture. You put them into a corner, even if they know it's suicidal, they will fight, because it's a matter of honor. Unless they could be removed, these sanctions, as the sanctions carried every penalty of war, except killing and destruction, no nation of dignity could withstand this economic warfare of FDR for long. Remember, General MacArthur's no dove. I mean, he's a hawk. But MacArthur said Roosevelt could have made peace with Konya in September 1941. He could have obtained all the American objectives in the Pacific and the freedom of China, and probably even Manchuria, because Konya was authorized by the emperor to reach a complete withdrawal, even from Manchuria, if it would bring peace to the United States. But there was callous indifference, not just to the foreigners, the poor people in China and so on, but to the American army beleaguered in the Philippines. I believe it was the desire of President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill that we get into the war, as they felt their allies, read the Soviet Union, could not win without us, and all our efforts to provoke the Germans to declare war on us had failed. He had ordered the US Navy to fire on German ships, to blockade Germany, to supply all kinds of weapons of war to Britain and the Soviet Union. They were doing everything they could to provoke Germany, but Germany did not respond to the provocation. And so, exhausting every means of provoking Germany into war with them, they went the other way of trying to get war going with Japan. MacArthur was bitter about Roosevelt's starvation of supplies at a time when the whole fate of South Pacific and the allies in Asia were at stake. Now consider this, and these are the facts that can't be argued away. When America was attacked at Pearl Harbor, you would have thought that America put all their energy into fighting Japan and fighting in the Pacific. But no. 90% of America's manpower, weaponry, resources went into Europe and saving the Soviet Union from Operation Barbarossa. Not even 10% of European manpower, money, and weaponry went into the Pacific. So General MacArthur's army on Bataan, on the Philippines, starved, ran out of bullets, bandages, everything, bread. They were dying of starvation, and they finally, after months of courageous holding out, had to surrender, and most of them died in the prison camps afterwards. So General MacArthur's got a genuine concern here. If we were attacked in the Pacific, why are we not doing anything to protect our men in the Pacific? It's like, who cares about American army in the Pacific? Uncle Joe Stalin's about to get overthrown in the Soviet Union. Our first priority is to save the Soviets. That's what the actions show. America was attacked in the Pacific, and they ignored it for years and put all their energy into saving the Soviet Union, which was the exact result of the war. And so the betrayal of Bataan, they held out from December the 7th all the way through till April the 24th, but finally, after months of being completely ignored, no resupply, no help from the US government, the Philippines crumbles, the American army in the Philippines are led off into the starvation death march. Very, very few of them survived. 15 American generals amongst the war prisoners. And it was a brutal imprisonment. But Roosevelt showed his vindictiveness in many ways, said General MacArthur. MacArthur told Roosevelt that peace could be made with the Japanese any time after the Philippines were taken. Because once the Philippines were taken, at the beginning of 1945, their supporting leaders were cut off, they were beaten, they had no raw materials, they couldn't survive. The war didn't need to have lasted so long. But MacArthur said Rutherford was determined that General MacArthur should not command in the final movements on Japan because he had questioned his orders. General MacArthur declared, "We would have avoided all the losses of the atomic bomb and the entry of Russia into Manchuria had the Japanese peace overtures been accepted in early 1945, which was a desperately seeking peace." MacArthur told President Herbert Hoover in 1946 that Truman's policies were enabling Russia to make a puppet state out of Mongolia and Manchuria and betraying all of China and Mongolia to communism. In September 1944, John Flynn, a member of the America First Committee, published The Truth About Pearl Harbor. This is 1944, the war still on. Rear Admiral Frank Beatty was quoted. At the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, he was an aide to the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox. Well, he testified, "Prior to 7 December, it was evident even to me that we were pushing Japan into a corner. The conditions we imposed on Japan were so severe that we knew that nation could not accept them. We were forcing her so severely that we could have known she'd react towards the United States. All the preparations in the military way, and we knew the overall import pointed that way." Of course they knew. They were reading their transcripts, they'd broken their codes. Project Purple, they knew exactly what the Japanese war dispositions were and preparations and their plans. Jonathan Daniels, Roosevelt's administrative assistant at that time, presented an eyewitness report saying, "The blow was heavier than we'd hoped it would necessarily be, but the risks paid off, it was worth the price." What a callous comment. It is an abomination for kings to commit wickedness, for a throne is established by righteousness. Which is why General George Patton said, "Politicians are the lowest form of life on earth. And liberal Democrats are the lowest form of politicians." And I'm afraid it's as true today as it was back then. Herbert Hoover observed, despite these physical losses and these moral political disasters and these international follies, despite the drift to collectivism, despite the generation government, despite the demagogic intellectuals, despite the corruption of government and the moral corruptions of our people, we still hold to Christianity. We still have the old ingenuity and our scientific and industrial progress. We have 35 million children marching through our schools and 2.5 million in higher institutes of learning. Well, maybe when he wrote that, it didn't look as bad as now, but I don't think that's any words for encouragement today. Today I think we should take encouragement from how many are being homeschooled. The promise of a greater America binds in the millions of cottages throughout the land, where men and women are still resolute in freedom. In their hearts, the spirit of America still lives. The boys and girls from those homes will someday throw off these disasters and frustrations and will recreate their America again. Now, forewarned is forearmed. In order to anticipate problems and threats in the future, we need to study the past. George Santa Anna said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "If we do not know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again." 1 Corinthians 10 says, "Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted." Now all these things happened to him as examples, and they're written for our admonition. The Bible shows us history is important. I've had people say to me, "I'm not interested in history." Well, most of the Bible's history, about 70% of the Bible's history. And that history is in the Bible for good reason. History does matter. And we should learn from it. Our Lord Jesus Christ said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And would you believe it? This verse is written in stone at the entrance to the Central Intelligence Agency. Go to Virginia, and just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., at the entrance to the CIA is, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Well, I don't think most of those people would know the truth if they stepped over it, which they do. But it's still true. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And truth does not fear investigation. Do you know how you can tell whether a person is telling truth or lying? People telling truth don't mind being questioned. People telling lie resent being questioned. When they make laws preventing you from questioning, when they seal files, when they deplatform people, when they don't deal with the issue but they attack the messenger, well, then you know that they're losing. And you can see this in many fields. So, for example, when it comes to the abortion debates, most abortionists aren't willing to debate us anymore. There was a time The last time I had a debate with Dr. Marge Dyer, Stellenbosch University, Dr. Death, head of the Abortion Rights Action Group, I happened to mention that my mother had considered abortion of me because she'd been taking thalidomide tablets. 1959, I was born January 1960. The biggest smile I ever saw on Marge Dyer came over her face, and she said loud enough for everyone to hear in the auditorium, what a pity she didn't. And, you know, that's the attitude of the pro-choice. They're not pro-choice, they're pro-death. And I've seen, at two separate demonstrations, banners carried saying, if only Mary had an abortion, we wouldn't be in this mess today. Not just anti-life, but anti-Christ. That's the mentality. So, and when it comes to evolution, we had Dwayne Gish here, 1990, from Institute of Creation Research, a man who wrote from Fish to Gish. Dwayne Gish, top creation scientist, trying to get people to debate. No one is willing to debate. Because the evolutionists don't want to be questioned. They can't win a debate. You can tell when a person is lying. You can tell when a person is telling the truth. Are they happy to receive questions or not? For example, you take Philip Stott, creation scientist. I've taken him up, organized meetings for him on the Hill at UCT, Stellenbosch, University of Western Cape, Cape Technicum. And there would be Philip Stott during question time. And you'd see all these heads of departments and professors, and they've got their books on how to question the creation side. They're throwing their questions at him. And Philip Stott's just smiling, rubbing his hands with glee, saying, I'm so glad you asked that question. And without notes, he'd just give the facts. And you could see these people getting all frustrated. Now, I didn't understand all the scientific technicalities, but I did understand this. In their own temples of secular humanism, the heads of department were left speechless, and they couldn't answer him, and Philip Stott was at no time disturbed, rattled by the question that threw him. He had an answer for all their attacks. Now, that's the point. That's the key thing, is truth doesn't fear investigation, but lies resent being questioned, and they will seek to deplatform you, silence you, and they'll bring out laws to prevent you from questioning you, and they'll call truth hate speech because they hate the truth. Amos 5 verse 15 says, hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gates. So, any questions, comments, complaints, observations, anecdotes? Calvin.
How specific was the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to Pearl Harbor?
To the, I missed your last few words.
To Pearl Harbor.
Okay, so, in the one sense, the headquarters for the Japanese Navy was Hiroshima. But the most Christian city in all of Japan was Nagasaki. In fact, Nagasaki was specifically started as a Christian city. There were 15,000 Christians incinerated in Nagasaki. It killed off at the core of a Christian university city in Japan. Why did they choose those two towns, both university cities? But Nagasaki was very Christian. And in fact, that was just crippling. I've shown pictures of the amount of churches in Nagasaki. Why did they choose Nagasaki? And there was 5,000 Christians also in Hiroshima as well. Still, it wasn't necessary to bomb a town. They could have, or a city, or where people live. They could have bombed a military outpost. They could have bombed a Japanese factory area, something like that. And it could have done it in the day when the people weren't in there. There was a lot of options that were available to them. And the interesting thing is, while I always accepted that the atomic bombs were absolutely necessary, I was astounded when I investigated it to find that all the American military leaders at the time opposed it, including General MacArthur, Admiral Nimitz, the whole lot, Admiral Kimmel, they all opposed it. And all the Republican political leaders in America at the time opposed it. And people like Herbert Hoover opposed it. Only the Democrats supported the Hiroshima bombing, and only the political ones. Democrats who were in the military were aghast. Even people like General Eisenhower was horrified at the use of the atomic bombs, and all said it was unnecessary because Japan was making peace overtures anyway and wanted peace. So it was so unnecessary, it seemed. But as it was determined at the end by people like Herbert Hoover and others, the atom bombs were not dropped to end the Second World War. They were dropped to start the Cold War. Because the people had just made billions out of the armaments industry during the Second World War, which was coming to an end, needed something new. And the arms race of the atomic age made a whole new possibility. We're going to make more money out of the panic of people being afraid of atomic bombs and an arms race, and then these weapons will all get redundant, then they've got to replace with the next ones, they get redundant, and they need more and bigger and better. So actually, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was to show to the world, and I said particularly to start the arms race between the Soviets and the Americans, and therefore this benefited the so-called, what Eisner called, the military-industrial complex. That's the theory put forward by Herbert Hoover that makes some sense, although you've got to be pretty sick to think killing 300,000 people is justifiable for that purpose. Any other comments, observations? These are just some of the different books that I've got. There's a lot on this. There's a huge amount of resources. These are just ones that I've come across. The research on this is huge. And it just is astounding that it doesn't matter how many facts come out, Hollywood just sticks to the old narrative. And isn't it amazing? Because the military people, they knew right from the beginning. The folks on the ground have done the research, and since 1944, 1945, the facts are out there. And there's still more coming out. But somehow or another, according to Hollywood, it just stick to the whole Pearl Harbor routine. And so when they come up to this, remember Pearl Harbor, it was, yes. And remember which government provoked this and wanted it and lied about it and didn't even give a warning to their own people and things like that. So seriously important. Any other comments, observations? Yes.
I was just like right now thinking about how you said 2010 the situation of people normally try to get flies. In their case, it's also where like should get protected, where like you cannot question it. Or like let's say like for example in the background say like if you the whole case of letting someone go and giving into them or something like that. What's the word? When someone is part of the church and then when they start sinning or something and then shouting?
Oh, excommunicate someone?
Yeah, Like if we all know that the Bible is true and Christianity is true, then why don't we let them explore and they'll come back to the same conclusion? Why should we excommunicate people? Isn't that like protecting the truth and covering it up?
Well, I don't think it's not covering something up to come to open court and church where people can defend themselves and you can hear all sides of the case. In a case of blatant heresy or gross immorality, that should be dealt with publicly. But that's not suppressing the truth. That's more like trying to bring the facts out, isn't it?
Why
should they take the person out? I mean, I was just wondering, like, those cases where an officer has to leave the church, the person himself is called to leave the church. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, sadly, in history of the church, excommunication has seldom been done against real pagans. Like, you wonder, why could they not excommunicate someone like, in our country, F.W. de Klerk? F.W. de Klerk, he went to the Pope and he received the Eucharist of the Mass from the Pope. Now, he's meant to belong to a Reformed Church. And here he's taking the Mass where the Pope claims he's re-sacrificing Christ, which is condemned as blasphemy in all the synods of Dort and Heidelberg Confession and so on. So every Reformed Church confession rejects it. But also, the Pope had no authority to give the Mass to someone who wasn't a Catholic member, duly confirmed and so on. So, on both sides, you take someone like Bill Clinton, who supports abortion and all these other things. How could he be a member of the Baptist Church? Where's excommunication for him? Then you can look at a person like Biden. He's meant to be a Roman Catholic, but he supports abortion. The Roman Catholic Church opposes abortion. Why can't they excommunicate a man like Biden? But who do they excommunicate? Reformers like Martin Luther, Huss, Wycliffe. Anyone who's making a stand for truth, they get excommunicated, whereas the real heretics, they become heads of the denominations or popes. So I'm afraid, generally speaking, excommunication has been abused in the church, but there is a place when you've got someone like a Judas to recognize he's no longer part of the 12 apostles. you know. Although Judas kind of did it to himself in the end, but still. Yes.
Did Roosevelt become extremely wealthier after?
Oh, he's always wealthy. He was privileged. He was born with a gold spoon in his mouth. He was mega privileged. And he was seriously wealthy, but his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt? Yes. She was a card-carrying Communist Party member. I mean, that's not a theory. She was serious communist. He was probably just a pinko. You know, you get a communist red, pinkos, the useful idiots. I think he is more than a useful idiot. He certainly loved the communists. I mean, if you make mistakes, you think you could have got something right somewhere along the line. But he pointed a communist in charge of everything. Like Donovan, who founded the OSS, which is the forerunner of the CIA. Total commie. Who, by the way, organized the assassination of America's top war hero, General George Patton. Which, you know, it's just unconscionable to think that you murder your top war hero. He probably did more than anybody else in the whole US military for their military goals. And, you know, the thanks he gets is a bullet in the neck and an injection in the hospital where he is trying to recover. So, you know, that's and Donovan ordered it and organized it. The OSS assassinated Patton. And one of the agents came forward and admitted to it back in 1970s. For his death, he wants to make right about that he had actually been ordered by Donovan, head of the OSS, who'd been handpicked by FDR to start this up. It's just disgusting. I mean, when you get down to what these guys do. Yeah, so FDR, probably one of the most evil people in the history of all that. When I was just 15 years old, I was reading history books by A.J.P. Taylor, for example. A.J.P. Taylor made the comment in there, a British Cambridge history professor. He said, Adolf Hitler was no more evil than Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I remember thinking at the time, huh? And, but he proved his case. Now this is written back in the 60s and 70s, so. H.F.P. Taylor's, I mean, he wasn't a radical. He was establishment. But he was looking at the evils done by Churchill and FDR. Well, I tell you, I've come to the conclusion FDR was more evil. What he did, and you've just got to look at some of the other things which we looked at other times, like the Catan Forest Massacre. And how, now remember, Britain's meant to plant a war to help Poland. But when Stalin, the whole of Polish officer corps, which represents all the intelligentsia and the leaders of the finest families of the country, put a bullet in the back of the head of thousands, about 14,000 officers and NCOs, judges, chaplains and so on, of Poland, all killed on order of Stalin. And Churchill knew this. And happily blamed the Germans for what the Russians had done in Smolensk, which is thousands of kilometers away from Germany. But they blamed Germany anyway for this and kept that lie up for ages. And when the Polish government in exile, that's General Sikorsky, and his daughter and his entire government in exile, were trying to investigate this further, because the Red Cross and 13 different nations, independent nations, Sweden, Switzerland, others, have been involved in exploring the Catan Forest Massacre, proved though a shadow of a doubt this is a Soviet atrocity done by the Soviets. And so, of course, there's action being wanted to be done by the head of the Polish government. What happens? FDR asks Churchill to get rid of Sikorsky, General Sikorsky, head of the Polish government, exile, who was murdered on the 4th of July 1943 in Gibraltar. Now, Britain's meant to be, and by the way, all the records of the communications between President FDR and Prime Minister Churchill for 1943 at that time, still sealed. Nobody's allowed to look at those documents. But the Polish people know a whole lot of other information has come out. Everyone in Poland knows the British Prime Minister and the US President conspired together to assassinate our President, our head of government in exile, and his daughter, and his entire leadership in Gibraltar to get rid of the questions about the ally, Stalin, who just murdered the entire Polish officer corps. Now, What does this got to do with the war aims? How do you justify this? That's just some of the atrocities. But what Churchill got up to, we're talking about FDR right now, but just to say about Churchill, you know, Winston Churchill wrote in his book on the Anglo-Boer War, not only that he supported Kitchener, concentration camps, scorched earth, all of that, but he said the most terrifying sound he ever heard in his life was the night he got captured by the Boers. He heard them singing songs. More terrifying than the sounds of incoming shells, he said. Now, what kind of person finds the singing of psalms terrifying? An unregenerate man, that's what. And you can imagine it put the fear of God maybe into Churchill. He hears his enemies singing psalms. Well might he have been afraid. But he obviously didn't let it lead him to repentance. So, sadly, I mean, this is just the kind of people we've got out there. Churchill also escaped from the Boers. Well, I asked him to give his word of honor as a gentleman that he wouldn't try to escape, so they weren't guarding him. Of course, he broke his word. So much for the word of gentleman. And one could continue. Any other questions? Comments?
Yes? I wanted to ask how wealth was distributed before World War I and World War II, but I feel like it's kind of a bit vague how to ask that as to country-wise, businesses, how it actually moved around, even up till now. I mean, I remember when COVID kind of came around and there were massive rich families, not just rich families, companies investing into vaccines. So if you invest in vaccines, and now vaccines don't work very well, what happens to your investment?
It doesn't matter if it doesn't work, they're still making billions. Because it's mandatory.
So now
not like it has to work, it just has to be mandatory.
Exactly. They moved it. So I'm curious as to know how the wars, their influence.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things that one can point out, but one of the most useful ways of telling this to me is 1910, World's First Missions Conference, Edinburgh, 1910. The first World Missions Conference, they evaluate the world at that time. And you know, honestly, the world was better in 1910 than it is now. I was at World Missions Conference 2010, a century later. And honestly, we had gone backwards, spiritually, morally, in many different ways. You can see how bad things have gone when you can see that in 1910, slavery was extinct. And widow burning was extinct, and so on. And they were anticipating the performance of the Great Commission and the extinction of all false religions by 1960, which was only 50 years ahead by then. Coincidentally, the year I was born. So, in 1910, things were going so well, the whole world was controlled by Christians. The superpowers were all Protestant. Germany, America, Britain. The most productive countries in the world, Christian. In fact, Christians controlled the whole world, with the Orthodox in the case of Russia, Catholic in the case of France and Austria, Protestant in the case of Britain, Germany, and America, but the world was controlled by Christians, with the exception of Japan, who was very enamored with the West, and was copying the West in good relations with Britain as an ally. China was a backwater. The Ottoman Empire was crumbling. But aside from that, the rest of the world was controlled by Christians. Today, there's barely one Christian country in the world. What has gone wrong? Well, 1914, sorry. What has happened is the destruction of the middle class. One of the things that FDR oversaw was the destruction of so many of the private farms in America. Millions of private farms were taken over by the state and big corporations and so on, in the whole Dust Bowl, chaos, New Deal. And America was socialized under FDR. He took a country that was very free enterprise and made it far more socialized. And a lot of the problems came from there. You can look what the Soviet Union did to Russia. It's just the results of the First and Second World War are so catastrophic. You can hardly imagine what the world would be like today, but for those evil wars, which were absolutely of no benefit to anyone except the communists and the banksters who worked together, really. So if you look at it that way, from a missions point of view, you can just see the world has gotten steadily more pagan since 1914 specifically. And just comparing World Missions Conference 2010, World Missions Conference 1910, you can see What's gone wrong in the 20th century? First World War and Second World War. That's the main thing that's gone wrong. And when you get to understand the goal of the Illuminati, Council of Foreign Relations, the Freemasons, the anti-Christian factions, the banksters, all these creeps, they have been working to undermine Christian civilization. Of course, Hollywood's really done its bit. And they've systematically broken down Christian civilization where people were safer and freer. And you just think that you could have traveled from Cape Town to Cairo in 1940s, 50s, in a normal car, not even a four-wheel drive, without a passport. You could have gone from Cape Town to Cairo. Just imagine, no passport, no visas, no inoculations, no four-wheel drive vehicle, and you could have made it across. You could drive across the Congo in the 1950s in a normal car in a space of 2 days. Now you can take 4 or 5 months with a four-wheel drive, and you'll never get across the Congo. It's just the devastation caused to civilization by so many of these forces. And now you can see where it's coming to, where they can literally try and tell you that you don't have a choice over whether they're going to pump some toxic, potentially lethal injection into you. You know, you've got to do it because they want to mandate these things. That's where we've come to, from a place where your integrity and your freedom was more respected, to a place where it's so anti-Christian, you can say something like, there's only two genders, or marriage can only be between a man and a woman. Next thing, guilty of hate speech. You can lose your job as a professor of the university in some countries. So you can see what's going on. We're really in a clash of civilizations. You know that the 20th century has been the worst century in the history of the world in terms of persecution of church. More Christians were killed for their faith in the 20th century than have died in the previous 19 centuries combined. That's staggering. That's really just beyond shocking. So that's the kind of things that you've got to consider. We're facing the most anti-Christian revolution of all time. When I speak about the Great Reset, I'll just use another word for reset, also starting off, the Great Revolution. This is just Marxist revolution in the name of the medical crisis. Believe me?
If I can just make a comment on the First World War. This was also the time when the wealth of Europe was transferred to America, because America was supplying the enemy and actually both sides up to a certain point.
Indeed.
And there was so much debt from Europe towards America after that. And actually, America was very poor before that. And that is actually where the big transfer happened. And one wonder how that motivates other things that happened.
That's so true. And that's well brought out also in the book The Unnecessary War by Patrick Johnson, how Britain lost the empire and the West lost the world. And he basically takes First and Second World War as one event, puts them together, and shows how, yes, America was the backwater and communism was unknown. But at the end of the First World War, Soviet Union was becoming a power, America had risen up. And after the First World War, Britain stopped making naval ships and America was just starting. And soon, the American Navy eclipsed the British Navy, which the British had the strongest point never to allow. At the beginning of the First World War, Britain and Germany were, in terms of industry and strength, vastly greater than the United States. But after you had the countries of Europe, Christians, killing one another at such a phenomenal rate, America rose, as you said, on the debts of Europe. And they benefited from, and at the end of the Second World War, they literally filled whole trains and shiploads with patents and industry and technology from Germany, shipped it over, including thousands of the scientists at Peenemünde and so on, people like Werner von Braun, who then led their Apollo space project. So that the looting of Europe by both the First and Second World War was staggering. Of course, the Soviets and the United States have grown at the expense of Europe as a whole. And that's another factor that's well worth looking into at the time. Any other comments, observations?
I just want to mention also that we learned in history at school that after the second, I think the first and second World War, a lot of European countries were in debt towards America, right? And apparently, Belgium was one of the countries that didn't have debt to America because of the commodity gold and things like that, but they were just moving in.
I wouldn't know either, but it's just extraordinary the reversal of fortunes in the last century. And that's why, really, those people who believe in evolution, that things are getting better and better, evidence is not in the line. Because just think how car handbooks used to tell you how to check the cam belts and this thing. Now it tells you not to drink the battery acid. So people haven't gotten more intelligent. When you think of the fact that you used to be able to have to debate in Latin to enter university, now you get remedial English in university, even after graduating. So it's pretty serious. Our society is being dumbed down. In many countries, education has been put lower and lower. Pass grades have been put lower and lower. In our country, you can pass with under 30%.
Yeah.
It's just incomprehensible. What I wouldn't want somebody who's gotten in the 20s and 30s percent to be dealing with anything with me, you know. So it's very disturbing. I don't think you can trust what's coming out of the universities now. Yes?
I'd just like to ask, you spoke about Christian countries and none being left. Do you consider Hungary and Poland as Christian countries? I know Poland is Roman Catholic, but they're very anti-abortion, very extreme, so I'm very anti-gay, lesbian.
I'm encouraged that there's still a lot of Christian life in Eastern Europe. And so there's some good things happening in Poland and Hungary, and there's some good things happening in Ukraine and Russia and Latvia and so on. I mean, it's not all bad, but you can't call them Christian countries in the sense that we had Christian countries 100 years ago, because in many cases, they've got legalized abortion, not in Poland, thankfully, but they don't have a Christian worldview in the schools. Many of them are like evolutionism. So, yes, there's still a Christian residue in many countries. Like, I would like to believe that South Africa is a Christian country. At this moment, it isn't. We still have a strong Christian element and remnants in South Africa. But the government isn't Christian. The country's not Christian. The schools certainly aren't generally Christian. We seek to be Christian, but we've been Christian in a very pagan society with a very pagan government. I think a lot of people in Europe are like that too. There's some very strong Christians in Northern Ireland, Romania and so on, but now I don't think I could call their governments or their countries Christian at this stage. Not by a strict definition. I'd say it's, you could take a vague thing, they've got some Christian ethos, but it's not to be compared to what we had in 1910. Here's a fact. First World War, 64% of Europe went to church before the First World War. Before the Second World War, by 1939, church attendance was 42% across Europe. After the Second World War, it went down to 5%. That's the average across Europe. England is about 4%. Germany is about 5.5% to 6%, and so on. Switzerland is about 12%. But church attendance in Europe, you can see the world wars play. I know it in my own family's life, because my father and my mother were brought up in Christian homes, and they weren't Christians. I wasn't brought up in a Christian home. And they would say to me when I brought up, said, we couldn't believe in God after what we saw in the Second World War. So both my parents were traumatized by the war, and they'd become totally secular. Now, by God's grace, they came to the Lord before they died. But still, the fact is, you could just see, whereas their parents, my grandparents, had been Christian. My parents were secular. Now, by God's grace, we've got a new generation rising up and rediscovering our Christian roots. But Europe was traumatized after the First and Second World War. And you could just imagine, the people, how could these things happen? And so the shocks, that you could unleash 1,000 bomber raids on cities, bombing cathedrals, homes, hospitals, just staggering. I mean, what on earth was going on in the minds of these people doing this? And the end result was Christian civilization was shattered in its heartland. Now, there's some place in Europe where they're rebuilding it, and praise God for that. But I think in many cases they're still brainwashed with the lies, 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 and more lies to justify the New World Order. They don't want people to look at the facts. Which is why we've got to keep repeating. Truth does not fear investigation. We've got to reevaluate everything in light of the Word of God, which is part of what the Biblical Worldview Summit is planned to do coming up next month. So, any other comments or questions?
Sorry.
Yes.
Was Eastern Europe always viewed as loading Western Europe
I don't think they ever called it Eastern Europe before. It might have been Central Europe. Russia would have been Eastern Europe. If you look at the map of Europe, countries like Czechoslovakia, that's Central Europe. How on earth did that become Eastern Europe? But because Eastern Europe is just behind the Soviet sphere. But realistically, even Poland would have been considered Central Europe before the Second World War. But afterwards, anything behind Iron Curtain was called Eastern Europe, including East Germany. But, you know, that's Central Europe.
So did they have a negative connotation before, or was it only when the Soviet
Union? These were the great capitals of civilization. Budapest and Prague and Vienna.
It was called the breadbasket of Europe before communism came.
Yes. Ukraine, breadbasket of Europe, it's a fact. And Ethiopia used to be breadbasket of Africa. They could feed all of Africa just from Ethiopia. And then after the communists took over, it was a place of starvation that needed non-stop aid coming in. Same as Zimbabwe. It used to be a breadbasket. Communists turned to basket case. But what they did to Europe, do you know one of the poorest countries you could find in the world would be Albania under communism? Friends of mine who worked in Ivory Coast, and Ivory Coast was vastly high standard of living than Albania. Albania was, as debased it comes to, the most atheist country in the world. And that was in Europe. So debased you could not believe how poverty-stricken and debased the people were. But that's what a 100% atheist country was able to achieve. So, yeah, to me, let's face it, there's nothing more important than people's faith. What you believe affects everything. And so the real impact of things, even more important than economics, is what's the worldview and what's the religious faith of people. That is what determines work ethic and everything else. Right now, most of Europe's in the mission field. Europe's done a lot to bless the rest of the world before these world wars drove them into insanity. Europe's done a phenomenal amount to raise the rest of the world in terms of education, literacy, and in terms of missions and ministry. But honestly, that evil men were able to turn Europe into such a slaughterhouse in these two hideous wars, which unfortunately get glamorized by Hollywood. And what they're doing is they're glamorizing it. They call it the Good War, but it was the Bad War. And they call it the Good War because out of it came the New World Order, the New World Disorder, and the powers that should not be, which are right now causing all. If the good guys won in the Second World War, why have things got progressively worse since? And this is the problem. Communism was saved, the Soviet Union was given the control of Central Europe, and they called it a good war. It was only good for the communists. There's nothing good for Christianity. And so that was the conclusion of Ian Smith, Prime Minister of Rhodesia. He said, we were on the wrong side in the First and Second World War. We would have been better off losing. We would have been better off being on the other side or staying out of it. But he said, we were on the wrong side. We fought with fighting for Christian civilization. We found we were fighting against it. We were actually fighting for the Soviet Union, communism, who's destroyed our own country. We didn't know that the British had already betrayed Rhodesia and all the other British areas in Africa over to the US and to the Soviets to be the playground afterwards. If we had known, we wouldn't have made all the sacrifice we made. And that's a sad thing. People like my father and Ian Smith, they fought all through the Second World War, 6 years of it, and at the end they were betrayed by evil people. And it's important that we know the facts, because if you just listen to the Hollywood rubbish, you know, the good guys won. The good guys included Stalin. And that's not the way my friends in Eastern Europe see it. All the Christians behind the Iron Curtain, they say, you betrayed us. They're talking about Yalta. Of course, they're talking about FDR and Winston Churchill. They were traitors.
What's the best way to actually change people's minds about communism? Because a lot of students at UTC, for example, believe that communism is good, it can work, and turn to him or their religion, that's why it failed. But if we implement communism in a way that's not religious, then it will
work. Well, there's several things, and we've got quite a bit downstairs. So, for example, I've got the heart and soul of communism, of the heart and soul of Karl Marx, and myth and communist liberation, myth and reality, and the greatest revolution. And these are tracks I've written to try and reach communists. And those are some that are available. Then liberation theologians have written a thing on liberation theology. I think the facts, for some intellectuals, they may need the black book of communism to see written by communists on their own archives, the unsealed files, 900 pages, drop it in liberals' foot, kill them. Documentation of their own files and the atrocities of the Soviet Union and their satellites. Those things can help, but Alexander Solzhenitsyn's books, I mean, there's a person who experienced communism firsthand. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, The Cancer Ward, The Gulag Archipelago. These are books from within Russia that should shatter anyone's belief in communism. I'd say that those would be some place one could start. Oh, George Orwell's 1984, Animal Farm. I think Animal Farm is an excellent parody, satire, political satire made on communism. All animals are equal. Some animals are more equal than others. And the pigs are the politicians. They keep changing the rules. No animal shall sleep in a bed and add with sheets. And then no animal shall kill another animal and add without cause. And on it goes how they keep changing rules. Where did he get these ideas from? Just looked at Stalin's Soviet Union. So, good. History and the Bible can destroy communism if one looks at it.